everybody, and welcome to the 101st episode of Media Voices. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
I'm Peter Houston.
This week I spoke to Julia Raffaele, the CEO of Associated Media Publishing in South Africa. Off the back of an experiment they ran in making their magazines storefronts for commercial partners, we spoke about the differences between the South African and UK magazine markets, why people are continuing to make time for print products, and the benefits of international collaboration between people who love magazines, which is everybody.
What is a magazine?
Oh God, that's beyond the purview of our discussion.
So, given that it's our 101st episode, that means that last week was our 100th. And for anybody who missed it, I mean, where have you been? But we had a really great live recording in London. You can catch up with that over on our website at voices.media. It's an hour, but, you know, it's a good hour. It's an hour.
Oh, it's a great hour.
Time well spent.
But ahead of my interview with Julia, we're going to do the news roundup again. It's been a while since we've done one of these, so it might take us a while to get back into the swing of things. But Byline, the sort of crowdfunded anti-mainstream media journalism site, is pivoting to print, promising that its newspaper will print what the papers don't say, if you can wrap your head around that paradox. Peter, what's going on here?
That's the best question you've ever asked on this podcast. Byline, which I was never that familiar with, was a site that campaigning journalists could crowdfund what they were investigating. So they would get readers to fund, the idea was they would get readers to fund their investigations directly. I don't think it ever really got anywhere. So the site was taken over in 2016 by its editors. They've just announced that they're going to do a 32-page monthly traditional format newspaper with plans to move to weekly next year. This, you know, on one level this sounds great, on the other level it sounds what?
Yeah, it's what's kind of even more what is it, if you look at who kind of these founders or rather these inheritors actually are, because one is Peter Jukes, who I think we've actually spoken about his podcast on previous episode of Media Voices, but he was kind of a playwright and a critic for a bunch of papers, and then he became a critic of the press during the phone hacking scandal. He actually crowdfunded some coverage of that on Indiegogo, which is kind of very, very interesting. And his co-founder is Stephen Colgrave, who is, and I'm quoting the Drum article here, a one-time punk rocker who was later an executive at Saatchi & Saatchi.
You know, I hate that phrase. No one who was ever a punk. No one. Who was ever a punk called himself a punk rocker.
Peter, save this for your punk podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Jesus.
So the primary focuses of Byline and print are going to include dirty money in politics, the rise of the far right, and the inadequacy of the wider news media.
I've got nothing against the anti... Well, I've got nothing directly against the anti-mainstream media stance. It's more a lot of the tone around this. It felt very like, let's go back to the good old days when like journalists were real journalists and... And there's another great quote in the Drum article that said, it's the Daily Planet and heroic age of journalism, this visionary idea where journalists would go into a telephone cubicle and come out as a superhero. I mean, what was he doing in that telephone cubicle?
Well, that's...
Good luck finding a telephone box.
Well, yeah, it's a weird analogy because there was only one journalist who did that at the Daily Planet, and that was Superman. You know, none of the
others
had
Superman. Well, it wasn't actually, was it? It was Clark Kent.
Well, it was Clark Kent that did that. But yeah, and then maybe Jimmy Olsen sometimes when he had
superpowers. Well, no, Clark Kent went into the telephone box. Superman came out.
Well, the cool thing about comics at the moment is that people say that Clark Kent is the real identity and Superman is the mask, but that Batman is the real identity and Bruce Wayne is the mask. So there's a whole thing there, but we're getting off topic. Yeah.
This is why you always have so much editing to do.
But anyway, so Byline in print has...
Sorry, I can't get past that.
What?
That's fucking nuts.
What are you talking about?
The Clark Kent is the real identity and Superman's the mask and Batman's the real identity and Bruce Wayne's the mask.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
Well, that's what it's been for ages. Bruce Wayne is the mask that Batman slips on to like do his public work, but really he's Batman.
I'll never see the world the same way again.
Anyway... So Byline in print, according to the Drum article, which we're quoting from here, has an initial subscriber base of 1,000 people, but it needs 5,000.
So I don't want to say this because I was going to sound really stupid, but then I see somebody's put it in the notes anyway, later anyway. If it costs £2.50 and it's monthly, isn't that a magazine?
You know what? Okay, can I just say something right before we get into this? It's going to be really, really easy to pick holes in this as an idea. I, for one, would love to see this succeed because it's just different. It's coming at stuff from a different point of view. We can criticize them for the references to the, you know, the Express in the '50s and the Mirror in the '60s and misuse of the word punk rocker and whether they're a magazine or a newspaper. There's all sorts of stuff. But anyone who's focusing on dirty money in politics, the rise of the far right, and the inadequacy of mainstream news, has got to be a good guy. They have to be. Thank you.
No, I completely agree. These are topics that absolutely need covering. I think they are being covered in a lot of places elsewhere. This isn't, you know, them suddenly launching this new heroic age, you know, because, for instance, The Guardian's been doing this, New Europeans been doing this. Yeah, I think that's what's kind of really sticking in my craw. As you're right, you want them to succeed, but it's this idea that none of the existing outlets for this in print are doing this kind of stuff, and I think they are.
And I think the print thing's a red herring as well, because...
Really?
Bureau... Yeah, I'm a big fan of print, a massive fan of print. But Bureau Loco and The Ferret in Scotland... they're doing stuff like this, so it's not all about print.
No, absolutely not. Is it just then a play for profit?
If they're trying to find profits, I would say there's probably easier ways to make a friggin' profit.
I mean, they said as well in the report they're looking to like appeal particularly to young people here, but there's nothing in any of this picture that makes me think, yeah, this is going to really appeal to young people.
Yeah, the Express in the '50s is really making a comeback among the youth of today.
It is, and I think, you know, you said the New European. Well, that speaks to like a direct group of people, whatever age you are, and what that's done has been amazing in their kind of anti-mainstream media stance. But this just sounds a little bit like old angry white men. Sorry,
that's no look completely legit.
But you know, it seems like if your columnists are people like John Cleese, who is a fantastic actor and comedian in many ways, but it literally all the people they've listed as contributing to this are angry at old white men.
I think the thing that makes me saddest about all of this is that the Drum article mentions Contributoria, and it mentions a couple of other crowdfunding sites that have kind of failed. And it makes me sad to think that possibly the economics of it don't really support, you know, a crowdfunded serious journalism site where people can vote with their
the
money.
The Correspondent?
The Correspondent, okay.
It's this thing, it's you can crowdfund a news brand, but crowdfunding individual news stories, that's never been, like, you always need a balance and a mix of things, and that's not necessarily what everybody desperately wants to fund to read.
I can see where like Medium is an example, maybe, where once the piece has been written, you can say, oh, that's really good, I'll give it a clap, or,
exactly,
or I'll give it some money or whatever. But to fund someone to go off and write something seems a little bit tenuous.
Hey, speaking of optimism, Disney is taking another write-down on Vice Media investment to the tune of $353 million. So it recorded the impairment charge on its ownership stake in Vice, which follows a further $157 million write-down back in November. And as a result of that, Vice has been sort of making some noise about consolidating and rebranding its verticals, so folding standalone brands like Waypoint, the video game focused one, and Broadly, which was kind of a women focused one or news for women.
So if I understand it rightly, when you fold brands into something, they basically lose their identity.
And I also wonder how much that's about staffing, that people are being shared across brands rather than just... You know, I'm only on Broadly. It's all of a sudden I work for Vice, but I happen to major on Broadly.
I just really hate this idea that by sort of folding stuff into bigger brands, I mean, that they've said they want to cross-pollinate readers. And I've seen so many, and it's always digital sites, I've seen so many digital sites do this. And what they completely don't get is that people come to you because you do something niche very, very well. And if you try and fold it into a kind of wider ball of wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff, it just doesn't.
Good reference.
It doesn't work. You lose your niche. You lose your edge.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
David Tennant is right.
Well, David's right. You're right. Everybody's right, except for the people running Vice. You know, the best thing about this story is it's just another excuse for me to repost.
I was going to say, could we? I almost wrote that in the notes. Could we get through it without you mentioning David Carr?
No.
But this is kind of another... So when we were putting the news roundup together and I was reading around this, basically every article I read about this mentions the fact that Vice was seen as sort of the almost the kind of the future of media in a, you know, or rather it was kind of this, the Hollywood Reporter says it has struggled in recent years to live up to its one-time status as traditional media's digital darling, which, great sentence, but it kind of does speak to the fact that Vice has been pilloried over the last couple of years for its kind of failures to meet, or rather to live up to its potential, or even to live up to the kind of the rhetoric that Shane Smith has said around it.
Well, I mean, you could literally insert any digital brand in that statement.
Nah. No, they were like masters of the bullshit. Absolute masters. That New York article, the company built on a bluff, it's just brilliant. And it just is absolutely spot on. It was just all bullshit.
You think that the bluff has been called now? They had to cut 250 jobs earlier in the year.
Yeah, the bluff was called months and months and months ago. Shane Smith is not my favourite human being. He's probably a lovely man. Probably not, actually. But, you know, as the founder of a media empire, he was a blowhard. And the one thing that you can maybe say is he knew when to walk away and bring in Nancy Dubuck.
Mm. He was very good at selling the sizzle. Yeah. Maybe not the sausage.
Yeah, absolutely. There was no sausage. That's what David Carr calls him out on in that video.
But there are indications that Vice is trying to turn this around. What is the point then in their new hiring spree? Why do we think that's worth flagging up?
So the new jobs that I saw on the list that's linked, and probably will be linked from the newsletter, they're a lot less like those gonzo journal, let's climb over a fence even when the door's open type jobs that they used to have. And more serious media jobs like, you know, ad operations positions, politics reporters, agency reps. There's even a finance manager for Viceland. I mean, who knew that someone was actually
keeping an eye on
Viceland? So, you know, that to me is like a grown-up hiring list, which I don't think maybe was there before.
But what will that eventually look like? Will it be able to keep that sort of counter? So they've recently launched a fun size can of their Old Blue Last Lager. So possibly they're branching out into craft beer or whatever. But that lager is brewed by AB InBev, one of the kind of the largest brewers overall. So maybe this beer that keeps the counterculture appeal of Vice but is underpinned by this enormous conglomerate that's actually keeping things in check and an eye on the finances is the perfect metaphor for this new Disney-backed Vice. In better news, though, while we were on hiatus, The Guardian recorded its first operating profit in nearly 20 years. So we do want to flag this up. This is something we've been sort of anticipating for, well, since the start of the podcast. So, Esther, why don't you sort of take us through what happened and where they are now?
Well, we've been anticipating with very raised eyebrows and very crossed fingers. It's a big begging bowl. yeah, so they've managed to record an operating profit of 0.8 million for 2018-19. That sounds bigger than it looks written down. The operating profit, I think, technically excludes cash payments of about 25 to 30 million. So it's, I think technically it's still loss-making. But the operating profit was what they aimed to turn around this year. So it's still really, a really, really massive achievement. Yeah, and I think credit to Pemsel and Viner for actually seeing that strategy through. Because they were projected to be making like £83 million loss at this point. So
well done.
Yeah, it's and
big,
everybody said
that.
Thumbs
up.
Yeah, definitely. Everybody I saw was very, very congratulatory. Everybody sort of said this is validation of the membership approach. It's also validation of the fact that you probably do need to take a haircut when you have, you know, an editorial staff of that size.
Okay, so now this is where we're getting into the cynical part of it.
What, you
not,
mean?
No, not the cynical part, maybe, but the reality of it. It's not a freaking haircut, man. There was 450 jobs went.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of people. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have gone. I'm absolutely not. I'm just, you know, I guess maybe what I'm saying is, should they have been there in the first place? that the reality of these finances is overstaffing or staffing the wrong places. Some bad decisions were made in the past and probably in terms of the international expansion as much as anything.
Would you say in retrospect that the kind of the use of their proprietary Berliner format was a mistake in hindsight?
Well, shifting to the tabloid format and see the money that they saved, that definitely made a difference.
Well, they're, in 2015-16, it was about 40% of their revenues were from digital, which actually, I think for that point, that's a pretty high percentage. Like that's not doing badly. But that's now up to 55% today, and they've had they've got, I think the figures were 650,000 recurring contributors and 300,000 one-off contributors, and that's just last year.
Now that's validation of their membership approach. You can talk a lot about kind of these one-off contributions, and we've questioned in the past how many of them would have been, you know, one-offs. But the fact they have over twice as many recurring contributors.
Yeah, and I don't know how the BBC managed to get hold of those figures because they've been really cagey about it in the past. The thing for me that was the most interesting is the BBC actually did a really great deep dive into this, and they said that there were four kind of key pillars of this turnaround. And the first was like a deeper relationship with readers, which was cutting back that international expansion a bit and actually focusing on what they do well. A greater financial contribution from readers, aka the begging bowl. A better understanding of programmatic, which I've no idea where that one came from or how that's turned out because nobody else has mentioned it. And then also it's what you're saying, it's about this agility to not just say they're going to cut costs, but to actually cut them. Yeah, it's the incoming wave of paywall fatigue I'm concerned about. Because, you know, if more organisations put paywalls up and you've got readers that are voluntarily contributing to The Guardian, will they kind of be forced to choose between that voluntary contribution or actually paying for another news brand that might have been free before? Will The Guardian actually have to maybe look at putting some of their stuff behind a paywall?
Well, they said they'll never do that.
I think that there's a couple of things to unpack there. One is they have significant early mover advantage here.
Yeah, definitely.
They have control over that audience that probably wouldn't pay to support another news organisation just because of who the brand is. And I think you're right that, you know, the more players that we see enter the space, the more likely people are to kind of jump ship or maybe do the thing that people are doing with entertainment subscriptions and maybe only pay for 1 month of one and then, you know, cut when they don't necessarily need it anymore. So they might pay for a month around election months or whatever. But yeah, I think The Guardian's is pretty well entrenched now. And in practice, are those recurring revenues any different from a subscription anywhere else?
I'd love to know where those people come from, like the geo breakdown.
Yeah.
You know, just to that point, you've seen, do people treat it as a subscription? I definitely do. I don't think about it. I pay it once a year, 50 quid, whatever it is, and it's done. And I don't think about it after that.
Mm.
Their stretch goal is to hit 2 million contributors. So best of luck with that, I guess. And as always, we've got a growing transcript section on our website thanks to a clever AI transcription tool from Trint. So if you just go to voices.media/transcripts, you can see them all. And there's a link to our dedicated email list that sends them out every Monday.
This week, I spoke to Julia Raffaele, who is the CEO of Associated Media Publishing in South Africa. We had a fascinating chat about publishers' use of QR codes in magazines, which are designed to turn each title into a storefront of sorts for its advertisers and partners. First, though, I began by asking her to explain why she believes print is back as a viable medium for publishers.
Well, I think for many years, let's just take the last 10 years, for example. There was this whole conversation that started around print is dead. And I think that was part of disruption because it had to have a starting point. So they started with print is dead. And I think what's happened now is obviously digital has had incredible growth. And I think it's a vital part of a brand channel mix. So there's no debating that at all. But I think that print is starting to be recognized as a very trusted environment for advertisers. You know that your consumers want to experience a very engaged user experience when they read something in print. And I think it has a sharp contrast to a much faster information, newsy, driven thank you that a user gets when they actually engage with the digital channel. So I think when print is used appropriately, it just allows more space and it allows more one-on-one and deeper engagement with a user. And I think when it's used properly inside the strategy for any brand, it's incredibly powerful, and advertisers and consumers are starting to appreciate that again.
That feels like a shame in a way, because it's not as though those publishers lost any of that expertise. You know, they managed to keep hold of what made print special over those years.
They did, but I think, again, depending on the objectives for each and every brand and how are they going to remain relevant and make sure that they drive conversations that matter and that they engage with their audience, who are effectively consumers. They're not only readers. They've got to be seen as consumers as well. Drives value for an advertising partner. So I think the thing is that we've almost done not a good enough job in terms of publishers, and certainly not quick enough, in my opinion, to sort of reskin ourselves and repackage ourselves and help our partners, who are advertisers and our consumers, understand why we are still relevant. So we've done a lot of work around a much more transactional strategy in terms of talking to our audience, and especially around shopping for product. And I don't know if you followed this in terms of our strategy particularly, but utilizing our brand platforms as shop windows. And in South Africa, e-commerce is still relatively small, but I think that a magazine medium has an incredibly important part to play in curating product for a consumer. And if you look at our audience, they still want the same things. They want to know what's the best, fastest, most beautiful dress. They still want to be empowered. They still want to be informed. They still want to be kept up to date. They want to be entertained. So it's essentially what we call ready to shop, is an extension in terms of our strategy of keeping our brands and our mediums relevant to our audience, and understanding that this is such a valuable consumer, and you have such a deep-seated, trusted relationship with this consumer as a medium, and you've got to respect that, and then you've got to curate content that helps them in their life, so allows them not just to see something that they want, but also to shop it. And that's very much around a much more consumer-focused strategy as a magazine medium.
So where then are you placing your chips in terms of, you know, being that major part of your audience's life, particularly when it comes to actually, you know, enabling them to shop, to kind of fulfill their consumer desires?
Okay, so we started this about 2 years ago, testing it in terms of our brands and our audiences and which environments would be easiest to place a QR code. And we started with a QR code because in South Africa, that is the payment gateway that's very well recognized. So it may differ in different environments around the world, but we started in South Africa with a QR code. We partnered with a QR code technology that was powered by a bank. And we started testing it. We started placing it around the magazine, but in a very integrated way, because you don't want to suddenly become a catalog. We also had to upskill our editors who were curating the product, because you can't just plonk any product in your inverted commas shop window. So it's taken us 2 years, and everything we do now, we test and then we analyze the feedback from the consumers. So what are they shopping most of? In South Africa, for example, 80% of merchandise that's actually sold is basics. It's not runway, but you obviously want your runway and your high-end fashion products, because that is part of the narrative and part of the story and part of the inspiration. But you've got to almost think like a buyer. And that's a totally different skill set from editorially what we were producing and curating when we only had print in one medium, versus now when we have print in 8 mediums daily versus one product in print monthly. So for us, it's been getting our teams to understand how the role that we would play working with retailers. We've done a lot of test cases and case studies working with one of the biggest retailers in South Africa, where we work with them to understand what's pushing sales of their product. And we showcase this in all of our platforms, and then we measure everything with all the data. And that's another entirely new skill set that we've introduced into our publishing world.
Well, actually getting all that data, the investment required to harvest all that data from the print product must have been huge.
It's a big investment of time and energy and resources. But, you know, for me, this was so vital to sort of understanding the next S-curve for publishing media as we saw it. And I suppose I was working with one of the big retailers, and I had this sort of aha moment where he said to me at the beginning of our conversation, which was 2 years ago, you know, I'm a retailer and you're a publisher, so I'm not sure how much we can actually talk about and how much we have in common. And that actually made me think about our products as shop windows. And it's funny, when you have like an aha moment and you can kind of almost frame your journey, like at certain points, then, you know, you've got somewhere to start from. But it's taken a huge leap of faith, and it's also taken a lot of investment to sort of bear with this and back this journey, because it's quite a different mindset to go from being very reader focused to consumer focused, but still remembering that you always need a balance in terms of your medium and your stories and your narratives, because otherwise you'll become a catalog.
Yeah, finding that balance between really creating great content and, you know, being consumer focused is something that I know a lot of publications in the UK are struggling with as well. So how's that consumer focus affecting the transition? How's it affecting your growth overall?
Okay, so we can see, and I'm actually going to give you a few stats. And for us, any growth is very important, because it was quite funny, but when we started doing it and we worked with this person in the bank that we met up with in terms of the payment gateway, and he was our partner, and he's a young, very dynamic guy. He was one of the founders of a company called SnapScan, and we started working with him, and he said, listen, if you change one person's behavior when they engage with your brand, you've actually managed to do something. So just start somewhere, you know, with an MVP. And it was actually like a kind of a wake-up call. Okay, let's just get on it. Let's get going with it. But just to tell you, like, from mid-December 2018 to mid-April 2019, which is a short period of time, our QR scans have grown from 7,000 to 17,430. Our page views in our shops grew from 47,000 to 84,441. And the products that we've loaded in the shop, which is our back end, which we call Ready to Shop, have grown from 1,500 to 3,174. So remember that this has been a huge learning curve for our teams. But I think everything they learn, they're applying immediately. And I think because we're a small, independent, family-run business, we've kept our offering quite small in terms of the titles that we run. We have a huge focus on the quality of content. We collaborate with very, great creative partners as well. And we're able to change quite quickly. We're able to remain agile. I think in the bigger companies, it's probably more difficult to almost just decide on a route and then get going. I think that because of the huge amount of disruption and change in our industry in particular, it's everywhere, but I mean, in our industry, in publishing, it's experienced really radical change. If you didn't have the advantage of agility, you were disadvantaged. So I think one thing that we've got sort of built into the DNA of our business is agility and also a lot of chutzpah. So we redesigned House and Leisure, which is our decor title, because we just looked at the newsstand and we said, this is just a sea of sameness. And if we don't do something in terms of designing an iconic cover, because in South Africa, 70% of your sales in terms of circulation, so printed copies, are still coming from the newsstand. So it's an important part of the sales funnel. So it's quite a departure, but go big or go home.
Well, you know, I suppose doing something as radical as that, making that bigger transition, was actually quite scary for an independent outlet like yourself.
You know what? It's one of those things that you just say, gulp. I'm going to swim upstream and I'm going to do it fast and I'm going to do it with the right people. And I think it's what's kept me very invested in our business and in media particularly. It's through creating work that you're actually proud of, because there is a lot of talent and there's a lot of talent in the world. But I've also realized through sitting on the FIP board that a lot of the people who sit on that board, they are seasoned professionals. Obviously, they do traditionally compete with each other, but most importantly, they collaborate, because we want a future for this industry. You know, we want this industry to survive and flourish, which isn't going to be easy. And I think that's why you need to collaborate. And I think we need to attract next generation of talent, which is my next little bugbear in South Africa. I'm going to start working with the educational platforms and organizations, because I don't know if they're teaching how to be in the new world of media. So I'm going to get onto that after our conversation. Yeah, I think that, you know, what's happened in terms of, like, who's the next generation who's going to and take over in terms of keeping publishing and the right content and the right, because it's not how it was. So how do they actually teach it? You know, have they got the right case studies? Have they got the right people speaking to students? Because I think that people, the next generation, they're confused about how to be in the world of media. Are they an influencer or are they a publisher? You know, where do they fit? How do they train themselves? You know, how do they make a business out of it? It's really important right now that I think we attract talent.
Yeah, exactly. We have this conversation quite a few times over here as well, because a lot of the times when we talk about, you know, magazine courses and magazine courses for people who want to get into, you know, magazine journalism, they're often taught by people who are, you know, fantastically well versed in the history of the medium, but they don't necessarily have the right skills to pass on to people who are just now entering that space and actually who might be able to bring new ideas to the table.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the time for textbook teaching in terms of the media. This is the time for looking at the success stories, looking at case studies, getting people who are opinion leaders, you know, in front of these kids, helping them understand how important like reading is and print as well as all the other channels, because each one has a different reason for being. And I think it's important to understand, how does the user feel when they are engaging with that medium? And not one is better than the other. It's about being exceptional and doing whatever it is that you do, innovation, inspiration, but also execution of a strategy. So I don't think they teach turnaround strategy enough. You know, if you look at where we've been as an industry, how we've reinvented ourselves, there are a lot of case studies now. And there are also a lot of failures, but you can learn from failure and you have to be prepared to learn. You have to be prepared to fail and be able to take that sort of intelligent failure, as it's called. So flexibility also, and working flexibility is something that is relatively new and a subject that we've really looked into in terms of our own workforce, because we have the majority of the people who work in our company happen to be women. So the new workforce wants to be flexible, which is great, and we are totally up for it. But if you don't have the right workflow system so that your output of your workforce is being measured in the appropriate way, then flexibility doesn't work either. Anyway, lots of subject matter to cover.
So earlier you mentioned a lot of cross-border collaboration that you've got going on with, you know, FIP, and you know, I imagine in your position, you actually get to talk to quite a lot of people who are grappling with similar issues, but internationally as well. So, you know, what lessons have you taken from sort of the international magazine community?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been in partnership with Hearst for 35 years, because when we started Cosmopolitan here, it was the first international title to come onto the market. And they've been the most incredible partner, I have to say. And they're almost sort of like, you know, a family. We've been through ups and downs together. I mean, 35 years of working together. And I've seen how they've changed their business and they've seen how we change ours. And I think, you know, there's value in exchange of information, looking at different systems, looking at how you structure your staff and your teams to deliver for an entirely new market. And the only way you can do that is by sharing information, testing it. South Africa is a great incubator for, I think, innovation, because not only do you have kind of a mindset, we've always been a little bit, you know, at the tipping point of Africa. So we're kind of used to thinking out of the box. And obviously not all your ideas are going to be good, but at least you've got a lot of ideas. And I think because we've got a very solid foundation with Hearst, and we've also worked with a lot of other publishers. We worked on Marie Claire for many years. We published Oprah's magazine when she had another title besides the one in the US. I think we've got deep-rooted relationships where there's deep-seated trust. So you are able to share a lot of information. And for me, sitting on the board of FIP, where I get a lot of inspiration is the mixture of people. So, for example, the head of media for Red Bull sits on the board of FIP. And they are having a conversation around an incredible case study of a business that is hugely successful in selling energy drinks, but doesn't see itself as an energy drink business. It sees itself as a media business.
Yeah, exactly. Like yourself, undergoing this transition and really making sure that they are aware of what their audience wants and what they can actually offer to their audience. Then just as a final question, we like to ask all our guests, what was the last piece of media that you consumed that you'd really like to recommend to our audience, that you want them to seek out, pick up, read, listen to, whatever?
Okay, so but I love reading, obviously, but I also love documentaries. And I'm a bit of a documentary addict. I love anything that's serialized content. So whether it is something that we're doing in terms of serialized, a story that you can follow, but you know, the guilty pleasure, I would have to say Netflix documentaries. Oh, I can't get enough. And I always show this to people because it's a way of utilizing also digital platforms. I put all the documentaries and the series that I watch onto Pinterest. And then it's almost like having a virtual bookshelf. And then when I want to recommend to someone or I'm talking about something that I watched, I go onto Pinterest and you've got your saved, whatever you either watched or you want to watch, or a book that you want to read, you've got it right there. So that's, and nobody really thinks of Pinterest as that. It's like a virtual bookshelf.
For any listeners who've decided to join us at this 101st podcast, we'd like to let you know that we do a weekly newsletter as well, which collates all the media news that we've seen that week, plus links out to whatever we've been reading and whatever we've been writing, plus links to our transcriptions, and basically it's your one-stop shop for everything Media Voice related. And you can sign up to that by going to voices.media, where there is a handy-dandy link.
And also, if you have listened to us before, why haven't you signed up to the newsletter?
And we're on social media, particularly Twitter, at Media Voices Pod. You can also find us on LinkedIn and Facebook, but have a look, tell me what it's like, because I haven't been by recently.
You can actually now find us on Facebook. Facebook has actually finally acknowledged that we are no longer the Media Briefing.
Woo!
So if you search for Media Voices on Facebook, you will now find us.
Yay!
Stop Brexit!
And of course, if you have any guest suggestions, please do get in touch. We've got contact details on our website at voices.media.
So thank you very much again for listening. We are now officially back off our hiatus. So we're going to be back next week with another absolutely fantastic guest. So until then, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye.